I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. This past fall, one of the most highly awaited books was published, The Last Line, Winston Spencer Churchill, Defender of the Realm, 1940 to 1965. It is the third in a series of books on the life of Churchill by William Manchester. The first volume, Visions of Glory, 1874 to 1932, was published 30 years ago, with the second alone, 1932 to 1940, published in 1988. Since then, the third volume has long been anticipated. There's a story of someone saying they were dying and appearing at the publisher's office in New York to read whatever they had in terms of a draft. In 2003, in failing health, Mr. Manchester asked his friend, the award-winning journalist Paul Reed, to complete the book, and has he ever. It's a remarkable book, magisterial, and a welcome addition to any history buff, Churchill admirer, or a fan of great historical writing. Mr. Reed joins me now to talk about Churchill in the last 25 years of his life, those war years, his own decade or so completing this book, William Manchester, and more. I'm a great admirer of William Manchester's work, which includes a biography on Douglas MacArthur, American Caesar, The Arms of Krupp, the book on the assassination of John Kennedy, The Death of the President, not to mention those two previous books on Churchill, and my personal favorite, The Glory and the Dream, his history of the United States between the years 1932 and 1972. The book is published by Little Brown. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Tryon, North Carolina today, Paul Reed. Mr. Reed, good morning.
Good afternoon here, and thank you for asking me to join you.
It's a great pleasure indeed. This is a remarkable book. It's a big book. A lot of years, not just Churchill's, but yours and Manchester. So to begin, now that it's been published and it's been out for a while, are you happy with the response? I mean, it's a bestseller. The reviews have been quite good, haven't they?
I couldn't be happier for those two reasons and more. The reviews have been wonderful, generous, and it's been, 8 or 9, 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and selling well in Canada.
Yeah, it was. I googled. I can't remember what I googled the other day. Just unrelated to our interview today, and up came the bestseller list in this country, and I noticed that it's quite high on there in the top 10. Does that surprise you that Churchill is still, of interest to a lot of people?
No, it's funny to Americans. You know, there's a lot of hagiography, and down here, people love him or hate him, and he's like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or George Patton. There's a big market in the States for Churchill books, and of course, people were waiting for this one. But I recalled, even when I was writing it, not so much recall, but Canada, you know, part of the Commonwealth and Dominion status a century ago, and a favorite place of Churchill's, and he loved the people, and he loved the country, and at his lowest point in the early 30s, I think he was thinking of buying a ranch in Alberta and just chucking it all in. So the generous reception in Canada is just wonderful, and I find that rewarding because you folks know your history, and to be on the Maclean's list and get these calls and letters from across Canada is just very gratifying.
Now, at the end of the book, the last paragraph or two in the book, you take us to, it's Westminster Abbey, where they have a plaque, and I'll use what's on that plaque as my question, is why should we remember Winston Churchill?
Well, my short answer to that is I really believe that any of us who hold dear the precepts and the 2,500 years, of Western art and literature and history and thinking, he fought alone for 18 or 20 months until America got dragged in, and of course Stalin by then had already been accidentally launched into it, and without that, and Canada was with him, and Australia and New Zealand, the entire empire fought from, if you will, May of 1940 when the French started going down to Pearl Harbor, 1941. That's a long time. And a lot of folks over here in the States didn't think England would survive, and troublingly, many didn't care, from Joe Kennedy to Henry Ford and Charles the Eagle Lindbergh.
Yeah.
So I think he saved the day, and what ifs are always dangerous in history, but it's pretty clear that had Hitler prevailed and had Halifax and some of the other cabinet members who advocated making a separate peace with Hitler in June of 1940, then Hitler could have bided his time for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, unmolested by anyone, and built his jet planes and jet bombers and rockets and atomic bomb, and Lord knows what the world would have looked like in 1948 or 9 if that was the case. We'd be doing this interview in German.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the stubbornness, I mean, the toughness, the resolve that Churchill had, I mean, these are qualities that sustained him during the war. They seem to be unique to someone of his generation. Say, I mean, he's a 19th century sort of guy in the 20th century. Are those qualities, I mean, I tend to remember at the outset of the Iraq conflict, people were looking for President Bush to be sort of Churchillian. Is it fair, do you think, to foist these Churchill qualities on, say, the politicians of today?
I don't think so, because, as you say, he was unique. Not remarkable, but unique, one of a kind, and in the 20th century. And there were great statesmen in the 20th century, Roosevelt, Franklin, Theodore Roosevelt, and but there was only one Churchill, and certain qualities he manifested, mercy and victory, generosity, humor, wit, literary genius. Any given statesman might exhibit one or two or three of those qualities, but the whole package, I don't think we're going to see it again.
As a statesman, I mean, you've just articulated why he was remarkable and why he was unique, but as a person, he doesn't seem like, well, I don't know if he, for me at least, it doesn't strike me as a guy that I'd like to hang out with. I mean, he seemed to be had a very odd relationship with his children. You know, the people talk about the drunkenness and the depression. Have you come to any conclusions about what he was like to be with day to day?
Well, I think I'd want to. Nobody would hang out with him, even his best friends, in our sense of the word.
Yeah.
But they would hang on his every word. He was Winston Churchill. Even in the 30s, when he was off in the political wilderness, he was a professional public speaker and would lecture on his books in the 1890s and early part of the century. And so just to sit at his table and listen to his stories, I would very much enjoy that. He, on the other hand, wouldn't want to hang out, as we would say, with me or you or anyone else. He was his own favorite audience, and I think toward the end of the book I have an entry from his doctor's diary that at the dinner table, Winston hits and everyone else catches. That was his little analogy, and that was true. Churchill really wasn't interested in what other people thought. He was, as a manager, he would listen to what his generals thought, and he'd argue with them and badger them, and invariably he'd come around to their point of view, but he was not interested in dialogue in a platonic sense. Now, I've got to say, too, that and this was important to me at the beginning, I found, and I spoke to several prominent psychiatrists and did a lot of work on this, and came to the conclusion that clinically, according to the Mayo Clinic Diagnostic Manual, he didn't suffer from depression.
Ah.
And that was important to me, and less important was the fact that I found that he drank more consistently than the old stories over the last 30 or 40 years, many of them brought to us by old friends of his who said he just nursed a weak whiskey all day long. nothing more than mouthwash, really. Well, if you look at his habits, his dinner companions, and, you know, there was a bottle of champagne at almost every meal, and wine, and brandies, and he did drink quite a bit.
Yeah. In terms of, back to the Depression for just a second, he talked of the black dog. People tend to think that was, I guess, his way of describing sort of the depression that he had. And you said that you don't think he had sort of the clinical depression that we would know of today?
Not what they would now call major adult depressive episodes lifelong, as far as, or even moderate adult depressive episodes, that the 15, 16, 17 diagnostic protocols for that call for manifesting four or five of these symptoms. And some of them he exhibited lifelong, of too much drinking, almost antic behavior. But he didn't, he was never inconsolable. He never felt loss of love for his family. He never could not work. And these are all symptoms of moderate and major adult depression. And he referred to the black dog in a letter in 1911 when I think he did suffer an adult episode of depression. But for the rest of his life, he never wrote of it again, and, you know, he loved his children. Again, he didn't lose interest in work, or he wasn't an insomniac. So I thought, wait a minute, and I talked to these psychiatrists, and I gave a couple of them a blind patient, if you will. I didn't tell them who we were talking about, and they said, no, it doesn't sound like this person is suffering from lifelong depression. And I went with that.
Now, were the years of Churchill from, say, 40 onwards, I guess till the end of the war, were those his best years?
I think so, and part of, in his second term, which a lot of people in the empire, and especially in Great Britain, you know, I had some English friends say, oh, don't even write about the post-war years, Paul. Well, he was striving then for a summit meeting with the Soviets. He wanted to avoid World War III. Mm. But during the war, yes, I think those were his best years. I spoke to his daughter, Lady Soames, at length, and there were days when his colleagues would say, oh, Winston's very depressed today, and a lot of days, and that word pops up in diaries, and I realized it's not a clinical depression. It's, for instance, the day after his prized battleships are sunk, or the day after London begins being bombed, and these were terrible days that would get anyone down. But he never got down. The worse it got, the more inspiring he became. And I think we have to keep in mind, too, that before the war, especially that previous decade, he was out in the wilderness. He was a political failure. A gadfly out there talking 10 years earlier about the threat that Hitler would pose. Well, when it came, there was only one man that they could summon to the leadership, and by default, that was Churchill.
When you write about the war years, as you do in this book, you have some marvelous resources, especially his own memoir of World War II, his history of World War II, I should say. When you read those, and you read, say, the letters, the diaries, as a writer, was he a reliable source in terms of what he thought of what happened and what he remembered, and in terms of making his case, was he reliable in that sense?
No. Not all the time. And I used his memoirs sparingly, especially when we added up the word count at the end of, you know, how many words I used from his speeches or from diary entries of colleagues. His memoir was, as he called it, his case. It wasn't meant to be history. And so somewhere early on in the book, I remind the reader, or if they didn't know, I'd tell them that Churchill's war memoirs were not history. They were They were heirs of omission and commission, and you got to be—they make a fascinating, wonderful read. But don't take them to the bank as far as historical accuracy. That being said, I used the memoirs, but again, sparingly. Half the time, I'd say, to show that in his memoirs he was giving kind of a counterfactual appraisal of something that had happened.
Did he dwell on, say, regrets very much? Or mistakes that he might have made?
No, I don't think he did, and he could have dwelt more on regrets. For instance, Franklin Roosevelt was not, I believe, and the record shows, was not Churchill's great, great personal friend. In fact, Roosevelt was, by omission and commission, helping to dismantle the British Empire. And after the war, in his memoirs, Churchill refers to his great love and respect for Roosevelt, and this was afterwards for the historical record, if you will. I think during the war, it was a very troubling relationship with Roosevelt. Churchill appreciated the American help, but there were times he said, and this isn't in his memoirs, but in the diary entries of his colleagues, that America is going to bleed us dry, America isn't being a good Samaritan, world freedom is at stake, and America's dragging its feet. But when he got to writing his memoirs, he left all of that behind.
Well, when you work on a book like this, I mean, it's about 1,000 pages in text, and then, you know, a bit more of notes and the sort. I mean, there has been so much written about Winston Churchill already. What was the goal in terms of writing this book? Was it, I mean, was it to complete the work that Manchester started, or was it to bring, say, something new on Churchill, a reassessment or reappraisal perhaps for this time?
Well, at first it was to complete the work until I realized Bill Manchester's notes weren't going to guide me to that end. His notes included all the usual suspects, all the diaries, the speeches. They comprised more than 5,000 pages, maybe 5 million words. So at first I thought, well, I've got to complete the third volume. And I realized, well, what does that mean, pretty quickly? And I didn't set out to, and there isn't a lot new out there, but as I began working and got a year or two into it, I realized there are new perspectives and new ways of looking at certain of Churchill's actions and his motives. And for instance, he never believed the Germans were going to invade England. Never. Mm. And he called it the invasion scare, and he milked it for all it was worth. So I thought, as I went along, that I've got to give the reader Winston Churchill and the context of the times, the wars, the battlefields, the U-boat blockade, his family, his drunken son, got to throw them all together and hope that my goal was that a portrait of Churchill emerges, not a history of World War II. And I think that that's how it worked out. There are some new angles in there, but there's certainly, you know, no recently released war cabinet document that changes the whole dynamic.
Manchester regarded Churchill as what? I mean, I guess he liked Churchill, right? He had great admiration for him.
He did, and this is part of... Now, Mr. Manchester himself, 30 years ago, was suffering from depression, and I think, and I talked this over early on with my editor, maybe every biographer does it to a degree, but as far as the depression angle, in Volume 2, Manchester has Churchill as being severely depressed, and he uses the word melancholic, almost in the sense of Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And I think that was Bill Manchester, in a sense, putting himself into that story. He did love Churchill. He thought Churchill was the greatest person of the 20th century and that he saved Western civilization. But at the same time, he projected, perhaps, psychological term, depression, mm-hmm. onto Churchill that wasn't borne out by the historical record.
And so was there an obligation on your part? I mean, did he tell you that this book would have to, I don't know, subscribe to whatever he thought, or that you had to have the same reverence that he had on Churchill, for Churchill?
No. He never, he never said anything like that, he wouldn't. when I say he might have put himself in the book, I don't think he was fully consciously aware of that. And again, perhaps I put some of me in the book. The fully formed portrait of the character was his goal. Leave no stone unturned. Don't leave out something negative just to make the character look more positive. That was his mandate to me. Give the reader Churchill as you, Paul, are going to, discover Churchill as you proceed here. He would never have said and didn't say anything along the lines of, give the reader Bill Manchester's Churchill.
If you had to describe Manchester's writing style, how would you do that? I mean, I talked to you a few days ago about The Glory and the Dream, which is a favorite of mine, and how certain passages of that, because they're so beautifully written, make me weep. And thinking about, say, how he wrote, and your own style of writing, your own style of prose. I mean, there is a dissimilarity, right?
Well, I think I may have said the other day, the goal in both cases, or any case, if you lined up 10 books, 10 authors, is to, of course, get the facts right and get the quotes right and all the journalistic rules and regulations, but at the end of the day, to tell a story that is backed up by the sources, but still, to the reader, feels like, an old uncle is sitting around the campfire telling a story. And that was Manchester's genius. But he hit the language he used in telling the story. I may have said the other day, sometimes it's over the top. And as my editor said, he developed his style almost a half century ago. And the style of writing biography and history back then was black hats and white hats and villains and white knights. And we decided early on, I've got to just bring a 21st century voice to this, which isn't going to sound like William Manchester's mid-20th century voice.
But when you read... But when you read the book, though, I mean, he's there, isn't he?
I am there in, and I'm serious, in the spirit. Yeah. He was looking over my shoulder for those 8 years. I tried to leave no stone unturned. I never thought at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll just skip over this. And I felt the awesome obligation to Mr. Manchester, but really, by extension, to the reader, to deliver Churchill fully formed, his good points, his bad points, and try to explain in the context of the actions why he would do something that we would now, looking back 70 years later, could say, with benefit of hindsight, my goodness, that was really dumb. Well, you got to look at what was happening on that particular day in 1940 and why he may have said or thought what he did. But, yes, Manchester is literally there for 100 or so pages scattered around the first 200 or 300. He wrote those. And then for the rest of the story, I think if I could talk to Bill, I'd ask him, did I follow the arc that you would have followed? And I think the answer would have been yes.
Yeah. So the second volume of the Churchill life came out in 1988, and then I guess in the early 1990s he'd written a book, another book on another subject. What happened in those years in the late 1980s and 1990s? I mean, his health was failing, but did he also suffer from, say, what we'd call writer's block?
Well, he told his son that he did, and what does that mean? Well, it means he couldn't write, but why? And I think that was the health, the mental health, the pressures and stress, age, so that, you know, something or several factors conspired to really, in the early 90s, that was the end of his work on this book. One theory, some folks who know him, and I knew him for 5 years, was that, and I can see this, that the second volume is almost a long one-act play of Churchill alone with the rest of England not listening to him about Hitler. And that's a simplification, but that was the drama. The third volume, I learned the hard way, and I think Bill Manchester knew this, there's a explosive expansion in the cast of characters. All of the Germans, the Russians, the Americans, the politicians, the generals, the admirals, and of course still the family and their families. And it would be daunting for anyone, but I think a man in declining health, it just stopped him cold for most of the 90s. And then in 1998, he suffered two strokes. And that was the end. Ironically, that's when I first met him and I knew him for the next 5 years, the strokes forced upon him sort of dietary changes and lifestyle changes, and he started swimming at the YMCA for therapy, and I think he found a measure of peace during those 5 years. The previous 8 years, he was hammering himself for not being able to finish the book. And those are the saddest 8 years. After the strokes, he actually had a measure of peace, and there was no need to fight it anymore.
So he didn't mourn not being able to finish the book, right?
He hated it. Be careful for me. He hated not being able to finish the book, I think, and it made him even sicker, if you will, and ate away at his health. During those years when, for lack of any other expression, he had writer's block, you know, he was in failing health, he hated not being able to finish it. After the strokes, there was no currency of you know, that bile anymore. It's almost a Churchillian trait that, what's the point? After the strokes, he realized there's no point in sitting around hating not being able to finish the book every day and to make most out of life that was left to him, and I think he did, and he found a measure of peace.
The other thing that's fascinating about this book is getting to read about you. I mean, we've sort of known about you for about 10 years. We saw your name when Little Brown announced that you would be finishing the book, but people knew little of you, and then now we're finding out, you know, that you came to journalism sort of late in life. This book has changed your life, though, hasn't it?
Oh, that's for sure. I think any book would change any writer's life, whether they were 53 when they started it or 23. I just never saw it coming. I was friends with Bill Manchester. I did stories on all sorts of people, and all of that being said, the book had to have changed my life, and it did. I loved writing all of my feature stories, you know, different feature story a week for 7 or 8 years, and they add up into the hundreds. And here we are, one story for the last 8 years, the book.
This whole process has changed you as a writer, I'm sure, hasn't it?
You know, if I went back into a newsroom and started doing feature stories, I think I'd have to readjust in a serious way. Yeah. The skills of journalism certainly came to bear on this, but it did. I mean, this is a 1,000-page, 480,000-word story, whereas my other, say, 800 or 900 feature stories were 10-page, 4,800-word stories.
Yeah.
Completely different dynamic.
Now, you told Brian Lamb on C-SPAN that you are in the process of thinking of a new book, You've got an idea on that. The process of writing this book, I'm sure, has informed whatever writing you'll do in the future, especially another book, right?
Oh, I would say that's for sure true. I'm thinking of, I want to play it close to my vest. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a biography, if you will, of a great United States public works project. And I would never, I'm not putting myself in the same sentence as David McCulloch, but along the lines of his wonderful book on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Mm.
And I like biography. I love history. I read history. But bringing a character to life, the drama, the personal human angle there is just marvelous. And that's what McCulloch did with the Brooklyn Bridge. He brought all of the people who built it to life and the bridge itself.
Yeah. And I'm assuming it won't take as long.
I hope not. You'll be talking to, Joe Smith, the guy that Paul Reed asked to complete the uncompleted work on the Great American Public Works Project.
So I was wondering, looking at the end notes the other day, these sources on Churchill that you used, that you consulted for this book, do you own all those books yourself?
Oh, I went out and bought everything I could.
Yeah.
You see, Bill used them in his notes. He'd Xerox a page from book X and put it in one of his long note clumps. And he had hundreds of sources. And it was just confusing, and a light went on about year two, and I went out and bought the Goebbels diaries and the complete speeches of Winston Churchill and the complete correspondence between Roosevelt and Churchill and Harriman's memoir and biographies of Roosevelt and lined them up around my room and just reinvented the wheel.
Yeah. And so, I mean, how many books on Churchill do you actually own?
Boy, I'm going to think that there's at least a couple of hundred in there.
Yeah.
And I'm including in that 25 or 30 on Nazi Germany and politics and, American history and post-war history and memoirs of George Kennan. Quite a bunch.
Have you heard from Lady Soames and has she seen the book?
I have not heard. We've exchanged a couple of few letters over the years and telephone interviews and I have not heard, because we don't have an English publisher, and I'd like to get her a copy of the book through the Churchill Society, but I have not heard. And I know the last few months she's been worried, if you will. Martin Gilbert has been ill, and so I hope in the spring at one of the Churchill conclaves I can meet her and hand deliver her an inscribed copy.
Yeah. Paul, it's been such a pleasure and a real honor for me to talk to you today. I very much appreciate your time and continued good luck with this book.
Well, thank you. And I lived in Vancouver for a while.
Oh, you did?
Long time ago. And I forget the name of the street, but could it be Robson?
Oh, yeah, downtown.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. About 7 or 8 blocks from Stanley Park.
Oh, is that right? Well, what brought you here? What brought you here? Was it work?
I wanted to go to the University of British Columbia. I should have applied first, right? But I was 17 or 18, and so I just drove out, and I ended up taking courses up the hill at, and now that this college is going to, about 8 miles out of town. What's the other college?
SFU? Or Langley?
Stanley Fraser.
Simon Fraser.
Simon
yeah.
Fraser.
Yeah.
Right. I took some night courses there, and the whole thing just didn't quite work out because I didn't plan it. So I came back east, but I was out there for the fall of 1968 and just absolutely loved the place.
I'm sure the Churchill Society here will want to have you out for this book. Have they contacted you yet?
No, but that would be, I'd love to go back to Vancouver.
Indeed, yeah. And if you're ever in town, do email me or so on, and I'll buy you a drink.
Sounds good to me.
Indeed.
And I've got your email, and send me another one, and I'll put it in my address book, if you will.
Will do.
All right. And thank you very much for having me on.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Last Lion, Winston Spencer Churchill, Defender of the Realm, 1940 to 1965. It's published by Little Brown. It was written by William Manchester and Paul Reed. Mr. Reed joined me on the line from Tryon, North Carolina. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.